More Idaho Matters now from the studios of Boise State Public Radio News. Idaho could become the latest state in the country to ban gender-affirming care for anyone under 18. Last month, House lawmakers passed a bill that would make it a felony for a doctor to prescribe hormones or puberty blockers for trans minors. It also bans sex reassignment surgery, something that is not done in the state of Idaho. Lawmakers supporting the bill paint these treatments as ineffective and harmful with high rates of regret. But as James Dawson reports, research shows the opposite.
Two narratives appeared during the House debate to ban gender-affirming care for minors. One of a deliberative and lengthy process with several safeguards protecting patients, and another claiming the complete opposite.
I had the opportunity to spend the day with a young woman who actually underwent puberty blockers and hormone treatment.
That's Republican Representative Julianne Young. The young woman she's talking about has been touring the country advocating for these laws, including a stop in Boise.
Hello. I'm Chloe Cole.
Cole, who's from California, says she began puberty at 8 or 9 years old and had to deal with comments from other kids and adults that made her uncomfortable. She says her family would tell her about the hardships of being a woman, menstruation, menopause, and others.
I would often hear things from other girls. Why did God make me into a girl? Why can't I just live life so much easier as a man? And I started to feel the same way.
She saw multiple doctors before one would treat her. Cole's parents wanted her to wait to take hormones until she was 18, but she says doctors pressured them into signing off on the treatment. At 13, she was on testosterone, just a few months after her initial diagnosis. At 15, she underwent a double mastectomy. Just a few months after that, she says, she realized she made a mistake.
I thought that I would live life easier as a boy that I was destined to be. But I learned the hard way that this was not the case.
Cases like Cole's do happen. A 2015 survey conducted by the National Center for Transgender Equality spoke to nearly 28,000 trans people. 8% reported detransitioning at some point in their lives, mostly because of social and economic pressures. Only 0.4% of those surveyed detransitioned because they realized they had made the wrong decision. Diane Piggott is a counselor in Boise. She's trans herself and was part of that 8% for a while.
I essentially convinced myself over time that I was not trans enough.
After repressing her gender identity for years, she eventually embraced it and began treating LGBTQ clients. Children must meet at least 6 of 8 criteria in guidelines issued by the American Psychiatric Association to be diagnosed with gender dysphoria. Those include insisting they're another gender, a strong dislike of their sexual anatomy, and a strong preference for cross-gender roles.
Sadly, there is no way to draw some blood and put it on a slide and say, look, right there is transgenderness.
Piggott says she's had to turn away clients who don't check those boxes, but that it's rare. That tracks with what Dr. Marvin Alviso has seen in his own experience.
In my 7-8 years of practice and with over like at least 300 patients, I think those are very little.
Alviso is a physician who specializes in LGBTQ care in Boise. He says Cole's story raised many red flags for him. He won't treat a patient without buy-in from both parents after explaining the possible risks. He waits at least a year before starting hormones in their mid-teens if the patient and their parents choose that route, which can have more permanent side effects.
At this point, the thing that you would really hone in is the ability for the kid to reproduce in the future, because that becomes greatly affected.
Calvin Udall, a 19-year-old trans man studying at Boise State, began taking testosterone when he was a teenager, after feeling for a long time he was born in the wrong body. He was struggling with depression and self-harm over those feelings. That 2015 survey found 40% of trans people reported attempting suicide, several times higher than the average American. When he was in junior high, Udall took steps to try to feel normal.
I cut all my hair off, started wearing jeans and hoodies all the time. And that was around the time we left the church, so I didn't have to wear dresses anymore. And I just started to realize how comfortable I was.
After a while, he asked his parents to start testosterone, which took multiple conversations. Udall underwent a psychiatric evaluation, and his parents were interviewed. It took several weeks before he noticed much of a difference once he began taking the hormone.
I remember getting really excited about noticing that my leg hair was getting darker, and my older brother was like, "You want this?" I was like, "Yeah, like it's extremely affirming."
Years later, when he was an adult, Udall chose to get a double mastectomy and a hysterectomy. Only a quarter of those who participated in the 2015 survey chose to undergo some type of surgery. Udall says he's happy with his decision.
I've had a lot of thoughts of, am I doing this for attention, or am I doing this because I've seen other people do it and it seems fun or whatever. And then I remember just how much it hurt before any sort of medical treatment.
Multiple studies published show this spectrum of care is beneficial, especially for those who start it while teenagers. Back at his clinic, Alviso says he won't leave the state and abandon his patients if the bill becomes law. One outcome he's certain of, though, is such a move would increase depression and anxiety in trans kids and could lead to more youth suicides. James Dawson, Boise State Public Radio News.
Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudette. We'll see you tomorrow.
This is Chip Brantley, co-host of the NPR podcast White Lies. Before we found the man in Vancouver, before we sued the State Department, before we snuck into the graveyard of a federal penitentiary, all we had were the photographs. Photographs of a group of Cuban men standing on the roof of a prison in rural Alabama. That's this season on the NPR podcast White Lies.